This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I want to read you something journalist Andrew Malcolm wrote after he decided to let his dying mother go in peace by taking her off the respirator that was keeping her alive. He wrote, "I don't think anyone can ever be fully prepared for the death of a parent, especially today. In the past, a son or daughter had to accept the loss and handle the funeral arrangements, terrible enough to be sure. Today, in addition to that painful burden, middle-aged men and women are routinely asked to participate in deciding when and how a parent dies." Malcolm explains how he made the difficult decision about his mother in his new book, Someday. The book is the story of his mother's life as well as her death, and about the relationship of mother and son. Malcolm is a national affairs correspondent for the New York Times, and he's written many stories on the ethical quandaries created by new medical technology. When he was growing up, the majority of Americans died at home, like his grandfather did.
He was in his own bed, in his own bedroom, with pictures of his daughter and his brothers on the dresser, and his wool vest on with the chain across the front. And everyone in the family was gathered around the bed, and we all remember his last words, which were, "Get this big stone off my chest." It was sad, but everyone was prepared to accept it. God seemed to be making those decisions. And the family doctor was there, but it seemed presumptuous to take someone to a hospital at that time, because what could they do? But today, we've got all this wonderful medical technology. Unfortunately, we haven't included the moral instructions with it, but we do have this medical technology, and it's all gathered in the hospitals. And death, really, as Russell Baker says, doesn't make house calls anymore. So 80% of the deaths in the United States occur in institutions where we can put these people out of our misery. And as a result, as I say, 70% of all deaths now are somehow negotiated or timed, according to the American Hospital Association. And that is, when do we stop doing all the things that we can do, and which ones do we stop, and at what point? And our society has always dealt with death as the one inevitable that we can dodge. If we don't talk about it, it won't come. And death is the D word. And as a result, suddenly families are confronted with these decisions, as was I, even though I'd been covering it.
You had written New York Times stories about medical ethics and about the difficult decisions families have to make about loved ones who are dying. But had you ever discussed the issue of living wills or anything like that with your mother when she got sick?
Well, I had mentioned the stories as I wrote them to her. She got the newspaper. She was not all that eager to follow my stories, whatever they were about, which is part of the problem that we had. In some ways, personally, I guess I always felt I never really could please her. And I would call up and say, "Well, there's this story in there." And she was very pleased to tell her friends that she had a son who worked for the New York Times and who wrote books. But judging by her conversation, she never really got around to reading many of them. At some points, I would try to lead her into this discussion intellectually. I didn't really fully realize what I was getting into, but I'd say things like, "Well, Mom, I don't really consider 1 in 10,000 a very good chance, you know, being on all these machines and everything. What do you think?" I try to hit it obliquely. And she would say things like, "Well, I don't want to stay past my time," or "I don't like all those machines," or "Your father was lucky he went quickly." And briefly, I thought, well, good, then I've got some guidance there, until I got outside her apartment and I realized that, well, who's going to be left to figure out whose time it was? It was going to be me, the only son of two only children who were my parents. And I really wasn't any farther along than I had been before.
How did you finally bring it up to her?
She was in a nursing home, and this is a few months before the end, and she had not been well, and she kept saying, "Well, you know, I didn't want this to go on like this." I said, "Oh, come on, Mom, you know, the way we talk, you're going to outlive me," and blah, 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 and say all the cliche things because you really don't want to address the immediate issue. And she said, "Boy, look at that cat out there in that tree." And there was no cat in the tree. And every day at the same time, she would see this cat, and there were other animals that she would see in the tree. And then a couple of hours later, she's perfectly fine. The doctors call it the sundown syndrome, and sometimes elderly minds get a little foggy late in the afternoon. And that was kind of a warning. I took it as a warning, and I went and arranged for it. What's called a durable power of attorney gave me the power to make medical decisions for her in the event that she was incapacitated. And so I was the proxy decision maker. It cleared the waters considerably. So I was determined to take some control. The irony, from my point of view, personally, the sadness was that I knew intellectually, but the dilemma for me was that the only way I felt I could live up to the values that they had taught me was to let her go and to let nature take its course. As one priest said to me later, you have to decide personally in your heart, when are we trying to glue the autumn leaves back on? And I decided we were trying to glue the autumn leaves on. But the irony was that by letting her go and living up to those values, that was left me as out in the cold in a way, because I never would get the kinds of affection and attention that I'd always liked to have from her.
At what point in her final days did you think that it was time to start thinking seriously about pulling the life support system?
Well, it probably, I knew it in my heart from the very beginning when I went out there the last week, but you don't really talk about it. It's clear and implied, the doctor using ominous terms. In her case, he didn't use the usual football fourth down or the last 2 minute analogy, but with her, he was saying, well, Andrew, we're going to have to be making some serious decisions here. And, you know, what does that mean? Well, you know darn well what that means. And how aggressive do we want to be? I had made it clear because I had made a point of getting to know him, at least on the telephone. We'd never really met. And it turns out he'd been taking notes over the years, make sure I wasn't some kind of a greedy son that was eager to get at whatever estate was left. So there was a feeling out of each other there. And I was not eager to pull any plug. I asked what treatments were there. It was clear that I was not interested in the aggressive ones, no kind of operations involved. I really didn't see the point in that. And her lung had already collapsed when they tried one treatment, so that didn't bode well. And I think it was Sunday, he said, well, we're backing off on the respirator now. And I said, all right, we'll try that. And I was there, of course, pretty much all the time. And that didn't seem to work. And on Monday, he said, well, and I said, well, let's give it another day. And so we did, and that wasn't working. And finally, the next morning, I said, well, we met over there at 7 o'clock in the morning, and I said, well, what's the outlook? And he said, well, it's not good. Even if we did get things back in balance, get the organs working again, in a few months, she might regain consciousness, and then we're faced with the lung cancer. I thought for an hour or so, and then I said, well, I really don't see the point. There was no outlook of any kind of return to a meaningful life. She would never be back the way she'd been, even when she was foggy in the nursing home. And so they gave me some time with her, and it was, needless to say, very sad and emotional. And I talked at her. I don't know whether she heard me or not. But I talked at her and explained what I was doing and what we would be doing with the breathing machine, and that she was supposed to breathe by herself, and they couldn't go on with this way, and the machine was scarring her lungs, and her lungs were so fragile because she'd been a heavy smoker. And then we took the breathing machine off, and things gradually declined from there, and 9 hours and 5 minutes later, she passed away. And I was obviously devastated. I didn't, you know, you can't leave the hospital room. I didn't know what to do. And yet, I came home and I said to a friend of mine and I said it very frankly and bluntly, how devastating it was. We had not been all, my mother and I had not been intimately close, but we had been this close. I mean, it's the only mother I had anyway. He said, well, you really should write this. And that's the last thing I really wanted to do. But the more I thought about it, the thought that perhaps some people could learn some lessons and avoid the kinds of pain and difficulty that I had experienced, even knowing what I knew about what was coming. And so I sat down and said, well, where did the values come from that last day in the hospital room that led me to make that decision for her? That took me right, of course, back to my childhood and walk through. And what someday ended up being then was really a journey of joy in a way. It may sound strange to say, but death in our society has become so clinical. There's so many machines between us. She had 16 tubes in her at the end. So many machines reading things that I wasn't sure we needed to know about what was going on in her body chemically. And they're wonderful things as crutches, as medical crutches, to get you over a hurdle. But I didn't think it was much of a life from the values that my parents had taught me anyway, for the long term.
You write that you were struck by how different your mother looked in death than she had looked when she was in a coma. And that made you think that there was really more life in her when she was in a coma than you had thought.
Yes, it's amazing, you know, even sound, seemingly sound asleep, how much life is there. I watched her chest rising and falling, and it did it with a click because the machine was doing it, and it had the size programmed in and everything. And when I first got there, I said, hi, Mom, it's Andy, I'm here, and so forth. And she made her, shaped her mouth in the shape of, oh, you know, like, oh, my. And a few minutes later, I came back, and I said the same thing again, and she shaped her mouth as if it was, oh, you know, like another surprise, and I'm saying the same thing. So you're never quite sure what they hear. And so I told her how much I loved her and recounted all the details of family life up until then, brought her up to date and so forth. Felt a little silly, honestly, in the ICU talking at this biological shell, but on the chance that she might hear it. And I was holding her hands the way she used to when I was sick and stroking her forehead and so forth, trying to be loving. I felt very uncomfortable, to tell you the truth. It was not an easy thing for a man of my generation to do. But I did, and I tried to be comforting in my way, and then every once in a while I would flee out of the room, sometimes go out in the hall and cry, and sometimes go out and get a soda or something and come back. They're very understanding, the nurses in the ICU. I mean, they deal with this all the time, and there'd been a man, the day before my mother went there, there'd been a man die in the same bed who had gone through quite the same kind of giving up process with the family, except in his case it took 8 or 9 weeks for the family to be agreed that it was time to give up.
If you're just joining us, Andrew Malcolm is my guest, national affairs correspondent for the New York Times, and we're talking about the subject of his new book, Someday, which is about his mother's life and her death. And we'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. New York Times national affairs correspondent Andrew Malcolm is my guest. You write that you had tried for years to prepare yourself for your parents' deaths. When you knew your mother was very sick, did you feel prepared? And at that point, what did you do to prepare yourself? And did that work?
No. I had prepared myself in the sense that I never left a conversation or a visit with harsh words, which we had exchanged frequently over the years. I would always end the phone conversations with, you know, how much I love you, or it was good to talk with you, even when it wasn't. And when I would use a lesson in my personal life, I lived a long way away from my parents, in some particularly powerful way, then I would tell them about it, trying to give them some sense of satisfaction, because I'm a parent myself with 4 children, and I wanted them to know that, you know, these lessons go on.
When you consented to have your mother's respirator removed, was your doctor putting himself in any jeopardy? In other words, could you have sued him if you wanted to? Is that something that your doctor could have rightfully worried about? Because I know in these kinds of decisions, one of the things the doctors are always thinking is this going to lead to a lawsuit?
That's right. Of course they are, especially if it's a divided family or if there are many members. In my case, it was me.
Yeah, you're an only child.
I'm an only child. My father had passed away already. I probably could have sued him. I don't know what for, but it certainly could have made a mess. I don't think I would have had much grounds because here I was legally the appointed decision maker. It was not me really consenting. You'll notice he did not propose that we remove the respirator. This was left to me to say.
Yeah, well, explain the language of that so everything is kind of on the up and up for both parties.
Sure.
Because there's the legal as well as the emotional aspects that you have to deal with simultaneously.
Well, I dealt in generalities like we'll do everything or make her comfortable or I don't want to be intrusive or I didn't want to be cutting into her and putting things in. I didn't see the point to that. Of course, I saw a very compelling point to making her comfortable. He was in very much agreement with that. If we had come to the point, let's say, that she did survive off the respirator but remained in a coma, sometime down the road we might have gotten to the point where we decide whether we continue pumping this orange chemical slurry up her nose for nutrition or whether we go and surgically implant a tube in her stomach. At the end he was saying, well, what do you want to do? He didn't say, well, we'll take this off and we'll do that and we'll do that. And I was saying, well, is there any chance of coming back to a meaningful life? And he thought, no. Had he checked with others? Yes. I just walked through everything I could think of as a reporter all the avenues of exploring for my mother's care, also to protect myself from guilt, because I didn't want, you know, right now suddenly to be stricken with, oh my gosh, I never thought about this. Why didn't we try that? And then I said, well, I really don't see the point, and to continuing on the respirator. We did not get to the point of discussing of removing the chemical nutrition. You know, this is not chicken soup, and I find that that, to me, in a way, that's almost more offensive than the breathing machine.
Why?
I don't know. It's not. It's a very emotional issue, feeding and nutrition, and you have this impression of someone holding their head in their arms and putting the warm liquid full of vitamins to your lips. It's not. It's someone standing by a bedside with a plastic tube that they've gone up your nose, and they do it just like a plunger, and there's this whoosh, and this orange stuff goes right up your nose and goes down into your stomach. And I was moved so terribly to come into the room and see this little tiny woman. I wasn't sure it was my mother in the dark, and I was hoping it wasn't, but of course it was, under the sheets there, and then lift up the sheet, try to find her hand to hold her hand, and they were tied to the bedsides.
They were tied to the bedsides because she tried to pull out the tube from her nose.
Right. And I said, you know, the technicians will all say, well, you know, people do try to do that. It's uncomfortable. And I'd say, well, have you ever had a tube up your nose? And most of them, of course, had not. They're very well-meaning. And I said, well, it may be uncomfortable. I suppose there's another reason, too, isn't there? And there's dead silence. And, of course, the other reason is that she didn't want to go on like that. And when I said that to the doctor at the end, he said, you're absolutely right. And, of course, it was up to me to decide, and I'm the one who knew her the best. At one point, they untied her hands, and she took her hand, her right hand, it had a gizmo on it that shines a light through it and reads the blood gases and how well the lungs are working. It made her finger look like E.T.'s, you know. She'd move her hand, and pointing this glowing finger in the dark. It was really creepy. Anyway, they untied her hands, and she took them, her right hand, and she went up towards her mouth, which was where all the tubes were. And the technician reached out like lightning and grabbed her wrist. I said, no, 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 wait a minute. And he let go, and she went up and played with her lower lip the way she used to all the time when I was a kid. She would nervously purse her lower lip with her fingers. And, of course, if I needed anything else to tell me that was my mother, that was it. But at least let her do it.
What, based on your experience and on the experiences of others who you've written about for the New York Times, what kinds of, new hospital regulations or whatever legal precedents would you like to see that would make these kinds of decisions more humane?
Well, I think the most important thing is for families to talk amongst themselves. This is where the values spring. We need to have channels open through legislatures for living wills and all the legal paraphernalia that comes with these kinds of things in our society anyway. But the most important thing is that families talk amongst themselves, even obliquely, something's better than nothing. And that they make these wishes known to the doctor. I've sat in on negotiations involving deaths in which their brothers and sisters, all of them are there, all of them are saddened. Maybe a couple of them don't want to let the person go, even though it's hopeless. And yet they do know what the patient's wishes were, and they all abide by them. It's very compelling when a family appears with a doctor united in what they want to do. Now, we're not talking about united in getting at the estate, and we're not talking about someone, you know, a non-terminal illness here. We're talking about in the final days. But it's very easy to convince yourself, if you have an aggressive doctor that you haven't really pursued this with, that, well, there really is a hope. I mean, it's 1 in 10,000, but, gee, let's give it a try. And here's this person who may or may not want this aggressive treatment. Because our society refuses to address these issues. And we want doctors to talk to us, and doctors want us to talk to them. No one's really prepared to start the discussion. So in my personal life, I've started the discussion with our family doctor. He's very comfortable with what I want.
What have you told him?
I've told him in general that I don't regard 1 in 10,000 as a very realistic chance, and that if I'm in a condition like my mother's, I would just like to go peacefully. If I'm in that condition and the Cleveland Browns have a chance of winning the Super Bowl, then I'll take it. Keep me going for another 2 weeks. But I don't want to exist for a long period of time. If there's any meaningful chance of recovery, terrific. Let's give it a shot. If there isn't, I don't really see the point. I'm not writing books. I'm not working. I'm not saving. for my kid's future to have it all go down some hospital toilet.
At what point in your life do you think it would be appropriate to start talking about this with your children?
Well, I already have, and they don't want to. And my wife doesn't either. We're of different philosophies on this. But my wife has gone through some very painful decisions in her family as well. From that pain, she would rather not talk about it. From this pain, I say it stops here. You can't make people talk about it, and I don't blame the doctors for that. They can suggest it, and they do. People pick up on the euphemisms. You know, we're going to have to make some decisions here pretty soon. Those kinds of euphemisms, and they pick up on it. But I found by reconstructing my life and the values with my mother in some day that I was able to capture a lot of joy, which had been lost in the clinical sorrow of the passing at the end. I couldn't force anybody to make any other decisions, but I feel so relieved now, having gone through this process. It was a painful one, but I do think that given the alternatives, my parents always taught me there is a time to be born and a time to live, and there's a time, sadly, for passing. It happened with people in our family. It happened with my pets, and one worked very hard to make the passing as comfortable and peaceful as possible. For everyone concerned, including those living left behind.
Andrew Malcolm, I thank you very much for sharing some of this with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Andrew Malcolm has written a new book about his mother's passing. It's called Someday, The Story of a Mother and Her Son. And Andrew Malcolm is also national affairs correspondent for the New York Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.